Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Amid a spike in homicides since the Baltimore riots in April, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake earlier this week pointed to a bright spot in efforts to reduce violence in the city. Safe Streets, an effort of the Baltimore City Health Department, which hires mostly ex-offenders to stop violence in four Baltimore neighborhoods. It claims its success in reducing homicides in those areas. The Cherry Hill site, where Safe Streets works, has not had a fatal shooting in a year.
With the Safe Streets model, the health department is using an innovative strategy to deal with homicide almost like you would a contagious disease. You know, you interrupt it from spreading. And that's what these street teams are doing. They are violence interrupters.
That was Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake. We wanted to understand what Safe Streets interrupters are doing right and whether it could bring peace to gun-ravaged areas of the city. So with me in the studio is Greg Marshburn, an outreach supervisor for Safe Streets at its Mondawmin site in West Baltimore. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
And also with me is Dante Barksdale, an outreach coordinator for Safe Streets. Welcome.
How are you? Good morning.
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fine.
Greg Marshburn, you work in the Mondawmin area where the violence erupted in April. You haven't had any recent murders in the area in which you work, right?
Not in 73 days.
Okay. But I understand you have mediated more arguments than usual since the riots.
Our average mediations is 21 to 25, but during the month of the riots, we had 42.
And what kind of arguments are we talking about?
Over merchandise that was taken from the riots. You know, the sale of it, the price is more than what they think it should be, and they think it should be less. So since you don't want to sell it to me for the price I want, I'm going to rob you for it.
And these are situations that you assess could escalate into a shooting?
Very well, because it's a respect factor. See, if I allow you to rob me for anything, then anybody think they can also. So I have to do something because people are watching. So it could very likely turn into a shooting.
So, Dante, give us a picture of what an intervention looks like. I mean, what do you do?
Well, pretty much it has a lot of components to it. The biggest component, I think, is that we have credible messengers. And these credible messengers look like the targeted population that we target. Most of our guys have lived that life out in the street, but now they've come with a new message. But while they were in the street, they lived by a code of honor that allowed them to gain a lot of respect in the streets. Meaning, so when we talk about that kind of stuff, we talk about the characteristics of these high-risk individuals, the things that they respect. They respect guys that haven't been prosecution witnesses, or you might call them rats or whatever. They respect guys that been stand-up guys, haven't been stealing and taking. You know, it's a code of honor in the streets, you know, and people have to recognize that a lot of the stuff that goes on in the street is being governed by sort of like a street code. You know, so our guys go into the community and they try to interrupt and intervene, you know, and try to change these behaviors. So looking at the three components, we go in, we identify and detect violence, and then we go in and we try to interrupt and we treat the high risk, you know, by connecting them to resources and things like that. So that's where the behavior change piece may come in. Now, our interrupters, you know, you don't have guns or bulletproof vests or things like that. But what they do have is their credibility when they were a part of that street element. So they go back in. We have also like workers that are outreach workers, because we have different, you know, different kind of team members. We have violence interrupters. We have outreach workers. Our outreach workers are the guys who bring these high risk individuals to the program.
And that's what you do, right?
This is what my outreach workers and my violence interrupters do. Our violence interrupters have a different kind of thing they do. They connect high risk and key individuals to the program because they don't carry a caseload like our outreach workers do. But what it
go on.
Okay. I said, you
that's Dante Barksdale, an outreach coordinator for Safe Streets here on WIPR Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Greg Marshburn, an outreach supervisor for Safe Streets in its Mondawmin site. And we're talking about efforts to quell the violence in Baltimore. I want us to hear something that Police Commissioner Anthony Batts said at a press conference Wednesday. He said the city's been flooded with narcotics stolen from pharmacies and methadone clinics during the riots.
That amount of drugs has thrown off the balance on the streets of Baltimore. We're seeing the repercussions of these crimes throughout the community. Individuals are getting high to a greater degree and at a greater pace than any time before. Criminals are selling those stolen drugs. There are turf wars happening, which are leading to violence and shootings in our city.
Greg Marshburn, are you seeing the effects of narcotics on the street? You talked about fights over merchandise. Does that include the drugs?
Yeah, it also includes the drugs because you have to look. A lot of people took a lot of drugs. So somebody might sell their drugs faster than somebody else. And now because they took it, they don't have access to get it. But I know this individual still has it, so now we're going to go take it from him. So, again, I can't allow you to take anything from me. I have to do something, and this is how the violence erupts.
So, Safe Streets operates in Mondawmin and Cherry Hill. Where else?
Park Heights and McGovernly Park.
Mm-hmm. I read that Safe Streets altogether covers 1.4 square miles of the city. Pretty compact. Could it be scaled up to work in more areas where we've seen so many shootings?
Yes, it could.
Yes. I think, according to, like, Daniel Webster's evaluation doing, like, I think 2009,
Daniel Webster with Johns Hopkins Center for Youth Violence.
Bloomberg School of Public Health. Yeah, he said his evaluation said that the more mediations that he saw, that the more incidents went down. So, you know, I always pitch this to my guys, and I always give them this vision. I say, what if we had about 150 guys on the ground, maybe about 25 different programs?
About how many guys do you have on the ground now?
Right now we have about
28.
Okay, so you're talking about
six times as many sites.
So I was thinking, you know, these guys are credible messengers. These are guys that can go into the community and get information that the police can't get and other folks can't get because of relationship. Our guys grew up in those neighborhoods. Our guys committed crimes in those neighborhoods. They went to prison from those neighborhoods. They returned back to the neighborhoods, most of them, but they have a new message. So the relationship with the community is the bigger thing. They know the clergy. They know the community members, the older folks. They know the younger folks. So there's a message being spread that violence is not normal. So when you go into a neighborhood and you implement a Safe Streets program, what you're trying to do is change the behavior and the culture of that neighborhood with individuals from that particular neighborhood who have the respect and the credibility of that neighborhood.
Okay, we're talking, if we're talking about, could this be scaled up?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not naive. I know there's not a shortage of guys in Baltimore who have done time. You've both done time, right?
Yes, ma'am.
But it doesn't seem to me obvious that there is a big supply of ex-cons who truly have turned their lives around and can be, as you say, credible messengers, but reliable messengers of this message.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, Greg, are there enough of you out there to do more than is being done?
It's definitely enough of us out there. And sometimes when we get individuals, this program changed my life. So sometimes a person may be straddling the fence, but once they get in this program and they buy in and tie into what we're about, their whole makeup changes, meaning that we have an individual that, see, because, you know, we all was followers at one point in our life, and I decided myself to follow somebody that was going somewhere instead of somebody that wasn't. So as a result, I have now somebody following me. And saying that, this individual left alone what he was doing. He got one job. He got another job. He go to school for social work. So this person went from being one of the worst in the in the neighborhood to the individuals, the older people being so glad that he works for us now, because they felt as though he was the worst in the neighborhood and he was going to die out there, to this program changing his life. And now he's a beacon for other individuals like himself and that grew up with him. So it's never a shortage of people. What is a shortage of is awareness, and a lot of people don't know about us in these other areas. And once they find out, then they'll start wanting this program for themselves.
If safe streets were expanded, given the narcotics on the street right now and the fewer arrests police are making, what would safe streets be able to do to reduce violence?
Well, we use key individuals. In these areas, right, we go get the worst of the worst that everybody respected. Because these people, the same people that we would get to get people not to do things are the same people that are getting people to do things. So now these same people that was once getting you to do something negative are now getting you to do something positive.
We've got just like a minute left, and I need to ask you about this. How do you think the police should be responding to this spike in shootings? I know you guys don't work with the police. You work with the health department. But.
Right. Well, I really can't speak, you know, to what law enforcement could do, because I'm really not a law enforcement officer. We pretty much know that we need the police, and we need them. You know, when individuals cross the line, you know, the police have to, you know, do their job. Our job is mainly to try to get guys before they get to the line.
Okay.
You know, so we're like, you know, intervention. We're trying to change behaviors and norms and get guys not to use violence to resolve their problems.
From the street where you are, what do you see police doing right now?
Well, I mean, I've seen law enforcement. They're out there doing what they need to do. I see police patrolling and everything. And we can't pretty much like blame stuff on the police, and we can't blame stuff on anything. We have to put the blame where it is. We need education, we need jobs, we need training, and we need interventions to reduce violence.
Anything? A perfect wrap up. I want to thank you both. We're flat out of time.
Okay.
Thank you both.
Right.
And I should say we did reach out to the police department to be part of this conversation. They did not respond. Greg Marshburn is an outreach supervisor for Safe Streets at the Mondawmin site. Dante Barksdale is an outreach coordinator for Safe Streets. More information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Mm. I'm Sheila Cast. It's 88.1.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Good morning, everybody. Glad you're with us this morning on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall, and I know what you're doing. You're sitting there and you're thinking to yourself, well, Tom, here's the deal. You have a pathetic life. You never go to the movies. You never do anything exciting. But I'm not you. I'm much more kind of like Nathan Sterner. I get out. I have a happy life. I have a fulfilling life. I'm well loved in the community. So I'm going to the movies this weekend. And here's the deal. The question is, what movie do I see? This is the question on everybody's minds. Well, gentle listener, you are in luck. Turns out that Jed Dietz, the director of the Maryland Film Festival, and Ann Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post, are both sitting here, and they're compassionate and they're empathic with the fact that I have a pathetic life, but they are willing to tell you what movies to go see this weekend. Good morning.
Good morning. We're I have seen you at movies, though.
You have seen me.
Yes.
And you may actually see me in a movie tomorrow. This is actually, to tell you the truth, this is a Dear Diary day for me, because I may actually be going to the movies tomorrow.
Because boy, do we have one for you to see.
Yep, and I think it's called Love and Mercy.
You are right, sir.
And it's at the Charles Theater, and it's like a biopic about the Beach Boys leader, Brian Wilson.
Yes, but it's a biopic, but the great thing about it is that it's not a biopic. This is an amazing film directed by a guy named Bill Pohlad, who a lot of us know is a financier of films more than a director of films. And so that's always scary when the money guy decides, I really want to direct. You're like, ugh!
Well, and he's money guy by virtue of being the son of Carl Paulette, you know, who's owned the Minnesota Twins.
Right. Nice Midwestern boy. Career. Right. Yeah. But he's got great taste. I mean, the projects that he has financed in the past have been terrific. And he's working with a script that was co-written by Oren Moverman, who wrote I'm Not There, the Bob Dylan movie. Mm-hmm.
That was a great movie. I love
that. Which was a great, but it's almost
the same. One of
the
three movies I've seen. I enjoyed it.
There you go. So in this case, Moverman has very smartly, gone at the story slant. He doesn't come, it's not a literalist biopic. He's really zooming in on two moments of Brian Wilson's life, the time when he was recording Pet Sounds and beginning to record Smile in the mid-1960s, and also starting to experience auditory hallucinations and some mental issues. And then 20 years later, when he meets his second wife, by which time he's come under the malign influence of a guy named Dr. Eugene Landy, who's played by Paul Giamatti in the film. Paul Dano plays the young Brian Wilson in those 1960s years, and John Cusack plays him in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And Dano is, you know, this is one of those movies I saw at the Toronto Film Festival last year, and from the moment that the movie comes up on screen, you see Paul Dano channeling Brian Wilson, just talking to himself or talking to an unseen person, and you know he's got it. You know, it's mm-hmm. just a phenomenal performance.
When you see that
It's just a goosebump, and then the music and the visuals and the emotion of it.
Yeah, you know, and Pet Sounds is sort of, it's one of those records that's come through history, like sort of on the same level as, you know, Sgt. Pepper or something. I mean,
absolutely.
It's like, it's an iconic record.
Yeah,
very influential.
And I think we were just talking about it before we went on air, and I think one of the hardest things for really good filmmakers to deliver, let alone a second time director, this is Paulette's second film, in 20 years. And I think one of the hardest things to deliver is the sense of the artistic process, because it often looks so sort of pedantic or just boring because you see Mozart scribbling or something, you know, and he's really captured it.
Yes, he's captured. It's just an absolutely beautiful film and so moving. And I don't want to give anything away, but for all of the suffering that Wilson has undergone in his life, it just is so triumphant. I mean, it just leaves you floating. It's just absolutely beautiful and wonderful.
Very good. So Love and Mercy, it's at the Charles Theater in Baltimore, opens tonight. Yeah. Another thing that's coming back to the Charles is a movie that, Jed, you had at the film festival called The Wolf Pack.
Yeah.
That's going to open at the end of June, the 26th, and that was what you closed the festival with. I mean, briefly, tell us what it's about. This is an interesting documentary.
Yeah, it's amazing. A true story about a group of boys, they have a sister, but it's basically about the group of boys who were basically by their parents kept in their apartment on the Lower East Side of New York for most of their lives. I mean, allowed out like some years just once, that kind of thing. Fear of the neighborhood kind of issues. But they are fed by their father thousands of movies, which they then recreate in incredible detail. And it's just jaw-dropping story.
Instead of Raised by Wolves, you're raised by movies.
Right.
I'm not sure which is worse.
Raised by Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
We got to talk about Mad Max, which is available in 3D. It's at the Landmark Theater here in Baltimore.
Has to be seen in 3D.
George Miller. And you wrote about this in the Post, and you said that Charlize Theron just steals this movie.
Oh, my goodness.
Amazing.
She just walking away. This was, you know, we may... Well, here's a good time to maybe talk a little bit about the Cannes Film Festival, which I attended this year, which was really kind of lackluster, I have to say.
Yeah,
it was
called
not
it glum
the,
in the
it
Post.
It was. It was just a little bit of a downbeat.
How can the place on the French
I
Riviera
know.
Be glum?
Because we're not on the... We're in like a dark room on the Riviera, you've got to understand. But the
With
movies
snarky
were really...
viewers.
Yes, yeah, right. But it was a little ho-hum. I mean, the offerings... in some years are like that. It's cyclical. And some of our, you know, most anticipated things didn't pan out as well. So Mad Max arrives, you know, on the cross set and just, you know, gives us all the kind of jolt that we need in terms of pure filmmaking. I mean, it's just such a, you know, it's one of those movies where all the values are intact. The aesthetic values are magnificent. The technical values, the high execution value is high. And then the actual kind of embedded political values, I think, are really important. And to wit, you know, it's called Mad Max, but really, honestly, it belongs to Charlize Theron.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of kind of implicit critique going on that I really appreciated.
Yeah.
And she's a terrific actor. Is this a lot better than the first Mad Max? How is the first Mad Max? Is this like the second or third Mad Max? I can't remember.
Fourth.
There's a whole bunch. So is the Mad Max franchise considered to be, you know, a good franchise?
Yeah, I think from the very beginning, it, you know, when Mel Gibson played the role that Tom Hardy is playing in this, I mean, I think it sort of blew people away. It made Mel Gibson a star, and the whole visual post-apocalyptic world that is in Miller's head, which is scary to think about, it, you know, I think really knocked people out, even then in a world as now in a world of computer-generated stuff and very fancy movies. One of the things that I read in an interview with Miller is that he did 2,700 edits [S2] Wow. [S1] In this movie, which is, like, that's more than twice, I think, the first Mad Max, [S2] Mm. [S1] And which was had plenty of edits. I mean, it was very action-oriented. And this whole thing is a car chase, but it's just stunning. It's one of the most beautiful movies I've ever seen.
Yeah, it just goes, it only goes from A to B to A, but within that, it's just, he returns us to a time of, like, spatial logic.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, his sensibility is so classical and formalist within all this kind of craziness that... It's very admirable.
Mad Max. Yeah, I'm the kind of person who's disinclined to see these cars
a lot of
blowing
people.
Up movies.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to hear you say that it's just visually so compelling.
Yeah.
And the performances of Miss Theron is just really incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a genre exercise, it's you know.
I think it's stunning film.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, Mad Max, that sounds like a landmark.
3D.
3D. That's kind of a landmark here in Baltimore at Harbor East. Jed Dietz from the Film Festival, Maryland Film Festival, and Anne Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post, joining me in the studio. I'm Tom Hall. We're talking movies here this morning on Maryland Morning. There's a movie in the at the Charles. It's also there currently. It's about a fashion designer, I guess, or a fashion person named Iris Apfel.
Yeah.
So the movie's called Iris. She's 93 years old. She's called a fashion icon. This is the phrase we usually use in terms of Jed Dietz. But, so I'm willing to use it here in terms of Iris Apfel. But who is she? I don't know anything about
her. Oh, she's wonderful. If anybody, I know of Iris... from my years of living in New York and reading the New York Times, because she's a frequent popper-upper in Bill Cunningham's wonderful candid
who's
shots.
In the movie.
Who's in the movie. Yeah. And I wish he had been in more, because for me, the two are sort of inextricably linked. But she's a doyenne. You know, she's a woman who goes out to things and socializes and wears fabulous clothes, all of her own, from her own collection. Some of them couture, some of them not, but she puts them together in wildly inventive ways, and it's a wonderful profile of her.
Mm-hmm. It's a documentary, and it's well done. Huh?
Yeah, and they had a textile business that she and her husband really created, and she had really a tremendous impact on giving people confidence. That is the most interesting thing. I mean, so much of the couture fashion world is intimidating because the dresses cost millions of dollars and, you know, who can buy them kind of thing. And she breaks through all of that because a lot of what she wears, she buys in secondhand stores or in, you know, African-American shops in Harlem. And you see all this in the movie. I would also say one of the most poignant things, as you see her and her husband at the end of their life together, it's also the last movie that Albert Maysles, the great documentary filmmaker, made. And a very young filmmaker, Sean Price Williams, worked with him on it. So there's sort of poignancy all through the movie in a wonderful way.
Passing the baton a little
exactly.
bit. Exactly. Yeah, an end of an era kind of movie. Yeah, interesting. I want to talk about a movie called Heaven Knows What, which isn't around here at the moment, but is on the way, I guess. This is... directed by Josh and Benny Safdie, is that how you pronounce their name?
Yep.
It's about, it's kind of like it's a documentary film style, but it's not a documentary. What's it about, Ian?
Oh, well, this was, it's kind of a naturalistic drama about a young woman who's a heroin addict on the streets of New York, and it's just sort of, it's kind of a look at her life and her obsessive love affair with another junkie. It's features this young woman that the Safdies really did discover on the streets of New York.
Who is now a recovering heroin addict.
It was shot by Sean Price Williams, and I think that is one of the strongest things about it is the cinematography. It's just gorgeous. The story itself, the sort of junkies in love trope, didn't grab me. I don't think that the movie necessarily really works dramatically, but she's a pretty engaging figure herself. Arielle Holmes is her name. And again, that photography really knocked me out.
It's interesting. Evidently, they improvised most of the scenes, and they use actors who themselves have had issues with drug addiction.
Yeah.
That's an interesting way to approach a movie. And it's not a documentary. It's a...
Yeah, these are fascinating filmmakers. We had them at the festival a couple years ago with a film called Daddy Long Legs that is not at all about drug addiction, but it has much the same sort of mix of fiction and nonfiction, and also some of the same artists that they work with. Ronnie Brownstein and his wife are involved in this movie too. So there are people to, if you're interested in cinema, it's something to look for.
All right. So it's heaven knows what. It's coming soon. We're not exactly sure. Well, I want to talk about a movie that's on HBO. It's called Nightingale.
Yeah.
This is a movie starring David Oyelowo, who was, of course, you know, so great at
King,
and is playing Martin Luther King in Selma. What's this one about?
So he's the only guy in the movie. These are new writer and director, and it's about a guy unraveling. And you see him in his apartment. He talks on the phone to various people. You're not quite sure whether they're real people on the other end of the phone or not. And he's preparing for an event that may be really going to happen or maybe not. And so it's a little study, 84-minute study of a type of mental illness and unraveling that's a fascinating thing to see. And there are a bunch of little surprises in it. And this guy is just an actor that I think you want to see everything he's in.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of reminds me of that Robert Redford movie when he was alone on the boat.
Right.
I mean, the whole movie is just him on the boat.
Right.
It sounds like this is just Mr. Oyelowo in this apartment.
And I haven't caught up with it yet, but I mean, he is such a galvanizing figure and such a mesmerizing actor that I can imagine him carrying just about anything.
Yeah. The American Film Institute in Silver Spring, Bethesda, wherever that is, opens on the 17th of June, so it's a week from Wednesday. And the opening night doc is, and this is a festival of documentary films, it's called Best of Enemies. It's a documentary about the debates between Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley in 1968. Those are two incredible characters.
Oh, man.
Jaw-dropping characters. I mean, these are guys who were real celebrities of their time, and you will not believe it. Even if you lived through that era and remember them as celebrities. Most people in my office never heard of these guys, but you will look at them with your mouth open, and just it's stunning that this whole thing happened. And it's the most wonderful movie to see because they're dislike for each other. It's culture wars 101, because they really resented each other, not just for ideological reasons, but lifestyle reasons. And you can see it all the way through the conversation.
Sure. Gore Vidal, openly gay. You're right. Mr. Buckley, not quite.
And it's also
openly hedonistic, not just gay. But
and it's also a capsule from a time when the public intellectual was a bona fide star. I mean, this was all contextualized in the fact that I think it was ABC. Was that the network?
It was
that
ABC.
Them
yeah,
was
who's
it
at the bottom
of the ratings, and they needed to gin up viewership during the political conventions.
So they
and
asked two intellectuals.
What
to
else
talk
are you going
to
do? Right? Ask a couple of eggheads on to talk, and it caught fire. So it's also this kind of glimpse at a bygone time of our era where intellectuals were not. They were not despised the way they are now, and they were true intellectuals. I mean, they were absolutely beautifully educated men,
right,
with great minds and great verbal swordsmanship skills, and it's thrilling.
Yeah, I saw a few clips of their debates just recently when I watched a movie about Gore Vidal, and so it was in the context of that movie, so this is a much fuller picture of that.
Yeah.
But it really is incredible how smart both of them
are. Oh, it's just...
And it's amazing to think that that's what commercial television was, too, in the 1960s when we didn't know better. The closing night of the festival is a documentary about Mavis Staples and the Staples Singers. It's called Mavis, and this is a movie by Jessica Edwards, and she's a Maryland Film Festival alum.
Yeah, we had her in opening night. She did a beautiful little film about the last manufacturer and distributor of seltzer water in Brooklyn, all handmade in those big heavy squirt bottle things, you know. It's called Seltzer Works is her short, which is available. Neither of us have seen Mavis yet, but I can't wait. I've heard great things about it, and it's so great that AFI's got this as their closing film.
Yeah, and I remember seeing that thing about the seltzer water, and it was just mesmerizing.
Wasn't it wonderful?
See, you do go to the movies.
I did. I went to the opening night of the festival that year.
And you know what I remember the most was the sound. I mean, just the sound of the bubbles and the fizz. I mean, it was so beautifully edited and mixed, and it was just an all-around sensory experience, so I can't think of anyone better to capture the sound of Mavis Staples.
Yeah,
and then we're also in the middle of all of this wonderfulness at AFI, Docs, I get to interview Stanley Nelson.
Terrific.
At the Guggenheim Symposium. So people should come down and
when
check it
that?
Out. It's going to be fun. It's going to be Friday night, the
19th.
Thank you.
And his,
7
and his
o'clock
film,
at the National Archives.
And his film Black Panthers was at our festival, and we turned away hundreds of people.
Right.
It's a great
remember
film.
That was one of the most highly anticipated and attended ones at the film festival. And congratulations, the festival went very well. Briefly, we just got a couple seconds as we finish up. You've had a couple of big announcements about the progress of the new theater, the Parkway Theater.
Yeah, we have a film online now, parkwaycampaign.org, about the new film center of Borning, and we will launch the public campaign on October 23rd, which is the 100th birthday of the Parkway Theater.
October 23rd, I'll be sure to be hiding on that day. It's a fundraising campaign. All right, Jen Dietz, Ann Hornaday, good to see you both. Thank you so much.
See you at the movies, Tom.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. We will have complete information about the movies we talked about on our website at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for being with us.
Is there an issue in Maryland that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Baltimore's Inner Harbor has seen a dramatic transformation in the last 3 or 4 decades. Tourists and residents walk and shop along the tidy promenades that line the water. But the water itself? It may gleam in the sunlight and sparkle in the night lights, but it is still polluted, unswimmable, and unfishable. A new report card from the nonprofits Blue Water Baltimore and the Waterfront Partnership of Baltimore gives the harbor an F for water quality. But those working to clean up the harbor say there is slow progress being made. And one of those people is Adam Lindquist. He's manager of the Healthy Harbor Initiative from the Waterfront Partnership of Baltimore. And he's with me in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Sheila.
What does this report card measure exactly?
So we measure sources of water pollution that affect Baltimore Harbor and our streams. Nitrogen and phosphorus, which are nutrients carried by stormwater runoff. Bacteria from sewage leaking out of our city's aging infrastructure. Conductivity, chlorophyll, and dissolved oxygen.
How do you measure that?
So we have a team that's actually run by Blue Water Baltimore that goes out into our streams every week with volunteers who take water quality samples directly from the streams in the city and in the county. And then those samples are taken to a laboratory where they are assessed for these different pollutants.
So what is the biggest problem the harbor faces in terms of water quality?
Well, we look at three different sources of pollution: stormwater runoff, bacteria from sewage, and trash. And those are the three main pollutants that are addressed by the Healthy Harbor Initiative. For me, the number one pollutant on that list is bacteria, because that's coming from our sewer system, which is, you know, 80 to 100 years old in places, and is constantly leaking sewage into the streams of Baltimore City. And that is really what keeps the harbor from being safe for human recreation.
So we're talking sewage, we're talking human waste.
Yes.
And that's dangerous.
Absolutely. The director of the public works here in Baltimore City, Rudy Chow, actually was on a WYPR a couple weeks ago and described it as a ticking time bomb. You know, this problem isn't unique to Baltimore City. Cities around the country are facing an infrastructure crisis. And you may hear about that. You may hear about roads and bridges needing repaired. But that crisis is also happening underground. Our sewer pipes are just very old, and they need to be replaced or relined in order to keep the sewage out of our waterways.
I've heard estimates of how much it would cost to renovate Baltimore's sewage system. I've forgotten what they are. Billions of dollars.
Certainly. The city is under a consent decree with EPA, which is a legal requirement for them to repair their sewer system. And I've seen estimates ranging between $1 to $3 billion.
And it would take years.
We're looking to Baltimore City to present a detailed timeline for making the repairs. They're actually in the process of kind of renegotiating that agreement with EPA right now.
Well, can we have a clean harbor before the sewer system is fixed?
So the cities that have made progress in cleaning up sewage from their waterways do it incrementally. And even in Boston, where they've cleaned up the Charles River, there are days when it is not going to be safe to swim in the Charles River, particularly right after heavy rainstorms. Our goal by 2020 is to get to a point where we have enough swimmable days that we can start to alert the public to when it is safe and when it is not safe.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Adam Lindquist, manager of the Healthy Harbor Initiative from the Waterfront Partnership of Baltimore. We're talking about a report card issued yesterday about the water quality of Baltimore's harbor and streams. Gwynns Falls is the only waterway to get a passing grade in your accounting. It's gated by with a D minus. What is Gwynns Falls doing that it's relatively better at?
I'm so excited that we have a waterway that received a D minus. We've been doing this report card for 3 years, and this is the first time one of the four water bodies that we monitor has received a grade higher than an F. I know it may seem a little sad to be excited by a D minus, but it's really great to see that really all of our grades are trending upwards, even if they haven't quite moved out of the failing range yet.
So what is Gwynns Falls doing?
That's the question, isn't it? We only have 2 years of data for the streams, and that's not really enough to understand kind of what's going on in that system. So we really need to collect more years of data before we can know if that's a real trend that we're seeing in the Gwynns Falls, or if, you know, maybe weather patterns this year just increase the water quality there a little bit, but it might go back to normal next year. We just 2 years of data is not enough to really draw a good assessment.
And so you'd say the same thing if I ask why the Jones Falls scored lower than it did in 2013.
Sure.
It's too early to tell?
Yeah, with just 2 years of data, we need more. But I can say that 2014 was one of the wettest years that we've seen while doing this report card program. And we know that in wet years, a lot more pollution is carried into our waterways. So the lower scores on the Jones Falls may tell us something about what happens to the Jones Falls during a heavy rain year.
This is your first harbor report card since you installed the Inner Harbor Water Wheel in May 2014.
That's correct.
It scooped up about 160 tons of trash in the first 10 months.
Yep.
What does that say about water quality?
Well, trash is really a quality of life issue. People don't want to come down to the harbor and see a bunch of trash floating in the water. It really, of course, means that fewer businesses locate down in the Inner Harbor. People are less likely to want to store their boats at the Inner Harbor if they have to deal with all of that trash. So by cleaning up the trash out of the water, we've created a more vibrant waterway for the people of Baltimore to enjoy.
How big a role does Baltimore County play in the water quality in the city's streams and harbor?
In the streams that we monitor, the Baltimore County has the same problems that we see in Baltimore City. They are also under a legal consent decree with EPA to repair their sewer infrastructure. So we certainly see, you know, it goes both ways, actually, because we've got streams that flow from the county into the city, but we also have streams that flow from the city into the county. So we see pollution coming over the border both ways.
In 2009, the Waterfront Partnership set a goal to make the harbor swimmable and fishable, as you said, by 2020. You're making very slow progress. How far behind are you?
There are a lot of great reasons to be optimistic about the turnaround that we expect to see in water quality. Certainly, the stormwater fee that was passed a couple years ago has created a dedicated source of revenue for repairing our stormwater infrastructure. And that's huge because stormwater pipes were really forgotten about in Baltimore City. We have, you know, think about it. People pay a fee for their sewage pipes. People pay a fee for their drinking water pipes. But there was no revenue to repair the storm drain infrastructure. So it's great now that we have that revenue. And we've already seen some of the projects that will be funded by that money. The water wheel is partially funded by that. Baltimore City has expanded their street sweeping program with stormwater funds. And in Baltimore County, they're doing stream restoration projects, which will also help to improve water quality.
So are you telling me that you expect the trend line, the very slow trend up to shoot up much more rapidly between now and 2020?
Yeah, we call it the hockey stick trend line that we would like to see in the years ahead, where it's going to be a slow start. But yeah, we expect to see a major increase as the city and county are making their sewer repairs and also fixing up their stormwater infrastructure.
Well, we'll keep in touch with you and see if it works. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Sheila.
Adam Lindquist is the manager of the Healthy Harbor Initiative to clean up Baltimore's harbor. You can check out the Healthy Harbor report card at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of Your Public Radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore. The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at ZEKESCoffee.com.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. Tomorrow is June 6th. On that day in 1978, the Orioles drafted a 17-year-old pitcher and infielder from Aberdeen High School in the second round. The O's would put him at shortstop. His name was Cal Ripken Jr. You know the rest. We're back Monday. Hope you'll join us.